Okay, so we started out at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where we installed supercomputers for physicists and weather people to use. We sneaked in at the University of Michigan. We sneaked in a super cool network rather than a crappy network that the AT&T people wanted. So by the late 80s, we had an internet, and it was everywhere. And we found a way to like let people on and do all this stuff. So the question is, once you have an internet, what do you do with it, right? So the next thing we do is we go to CERN in 1990. So you probably, how many people have been to CERN? Okay. So you probably would imagine that there's like a bunch of people with gray beards and like paper and drawing little pictures of atoms and stuff like that and looking at the sky and stuff like that. There are people with gray beards, but they, physics is the coolest field of that I've ever met. Because you can like be a physicist and learn how to weld, because they make gadgets. It turns out that 200 years ago you could do physics with a pad of paper and draw little pictures of molecules, but you can't do that anymore. Starting in the 20s and the 30s, the thing you would do is try to break atoms into pieces, and they had these things called cloud chambers, which were like super cool thing, and they would run a little, it would leave this mist trail, and they would plot those and figure out what was going on and electrons and all that crap. And what happened was is that they would start, and all the physicists would have a gadget like this big in their lab, and then they would figure out all they could figure out about atoms with a gadget this big. And then they would have to make a gadget twice as big to learn something more about atoms. And then we have to make a gadget twice as big as that. So what happened was, sooner or later, the gadgets that they needed to figure out what was next got so big that pretty soon there was like only one gadget in a country. And then they got to the point where the gadgets are so big that they could only have one gadget in the whole world. Now, when you have one gadget so big, that's 6 stories tall and 6 stories wide and buried 10 stories underground with a 20-mile tunnel, it takes a while to build that. The engineering of building what they do at CERN is quite amazing. It takes 15 to 20 years to build a CERN experiment. And during that time, you have a bunch of young physicists living in Geneva, Switzerland, on the border between Switzerland and France, who are like working their tails off like 9 hours a day. But they're not working 24 hours a day. They are partying the rest of the time. If you go to CERN, and I encourage you to go to CERN, maybe we got people at Michigan in the back because there's a number of Michigan physicists that just live there. These people have a lot of fun, and they're from all these cultures. It's this really weird summer camp for geniuses. And it's so fun to go. And I first went to CERN in 1999. I spent most of my career at Michigan State University, the first 17 years of my career at Michigan State University. And at some point, the University of Michigan came to me and said, "You're too good for Michigan State University. You should go to work at a real school." And so they kind of, just like a person gets called up from the minor leagues to the big leagues, and they carry your luggage around in the big leagues and all that stuff. So I got pulled up to the big leagues. And when I got pulled up to the big leagues, they basically had adopted software that I built when I was at Michigan State University. And CERN, some Michigan physicists at CERN were trying to use my software, and it was having trouble. So they got me this credit card that I still have today. It's an awesome credit card. It's blue and gold credit card. It has a beautiful little yellow M on this. It's not the case anymore, but I used to have a $50,000 monthly limit on this card. So they hand me this card and say, "Welcome to the big time. You need to go down to Best Buy, buy yourself a bunch of laptops, buy yourself a bunch of cameras, stick them in luggage, fly yourself to CERN for a couple of weeks, and help these guys figure out how to record lectures using your software." I'm like, this is going to be a great job. So the film that I will show you, you can see I'm really cocky. I was sitting on top of the world, right? I go from kind of being up there in East Lansing to like CERN, and it's like, wow, my life has changed completely. And And so these folks have a lot of fun. CERN is a great place. It's a high-energy place, lots of young people. The people I have on this picture are called the CERNets, that are alleged to be the first band photo on the internet. They are, some of them work at CERN, some of them are spouses of people that work at CERN. They just retired and had their last concert, so if you look at the CERNets, you'll see that they had their last concert. Their songs are all about colliders and love songs about the web and fax machines and stuff like that. And they're kind of a 50 doo-wop girl band, and but they sing about the web and packets and stuff like that. So it's just pretty neat. And of course, I've met them, spent time with them. I've been to CERN a bunch of times. I'm probably the only person in this room that has a family picture in the bowels of CERN. So this picture here is the current Atlas detector. It's 6 stories tall. That little hole you see, which is itself a story tall, that's halfway up. So this was in 2004, and the only part that was built was below where we were at. And so that's my wife and son and daughter and me in CERN taking a tour. And so I took my family on a CERN tour. My friend Stephen Goldfarb, who is in the lower left of that picture. So one of the things that they do, they have these clubs, softball clubs, cricket clubs. They also have a music club and a bunch of bands. And Steve, who's a physicist, is in a band called the Canets Blues Band. So the CERNets are the female doo-wop band that's a bunch of physicists. The Canets are, a mostly guy. And in 2008, I went back to CERN. Actually, 2006. Oh, no, okay, so 2008, I went back to CERN. I don't have a picture up there. I went back in the pit. The pit was almost finished. They were filming Angels and Demons at the time, because the movie Angels and Demons was being filmed. And so Steve turns out to be one of the tour guides, but we can't go anymore, but they were just about to turn it on. Angels and Demons was filming, it was almost full. I almost ended up in a film because the camera was still moving around and stuff. But that night, he sings in a blues band, and he let me sing one song, and that's all there sitting up there on the web. Got my mojo working that I sing the song. And then this is the CERN cafeteria, where it's really good food. And this is France, so like lunch is really tasty in France. They have steak, and they have like wine, little running wine machine, and you just got to go. I mean, it's really, really cool, right? And it's just wonderful people. I mean, like everybody has a zillion IQ just to sort of walk in the door, and then they drop it at the door, and everyone has a really great time. Physicists do welding. There was one point in time where like they were building, the Michigan people were building some titanium magnet, and they said that like 8% of the entire world's titanium production had been sucked up for some number of months so that this magnet could be made. That's the kind of crazy stuff that they do. Why did I tell you all that? Well, these kinds of cool things happen where stuff connects. Cross-disciplinary activities, right? These may be physicists, but they had other problems to solve. And so in this video, we're going to meet one of the co-founders of the World Wide Web. His name is Robert Caillou. And he and Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web in 1990. And so I guess I'll let Robert tell the story and then reflect on Robert's story. So I was filming this one. I filmed this in 1999, and this was immediately after I had just switched from Michigan State to Michigan, and I was feeling kind of cocky. And my hairstyle changes based on kind of my internal mental state. And this was kind of my worst hairstyle of all, because I had a ponytail. So you will see, just in case, you know, avert your eyes, because I don't want to damage you, because I had a ponytail. Because I was just thinking I was the coolest guy in the whole world at this point. So I grew a ponytail when I first came. Not my best look. But this is a really cool museum. No matter what, they'll let you in the museum. So you just show up and they'll let you in the museum. They'll give you tours. That's the first web server.
Hi. Hi, Charles Severns here. I'm at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, one of the world's preeminent high-energy physics facilities. We were lucky enough to talk to Robert Caillou, one of the co-founders of the World Wide Web.
The big collaboration that CERN is speaking here is a member of one of them. Have people spread all over the world and use CERN as the infrastructure to do the experiments, and so obviously the whole of high-energy physics has been a sort of miniature information society since way back when, since there were networks, essentially. And so, because we have this need for spreading documentation around, we build these things in like centralized databases, like CERN.doc, you know, or you could use it, but whatever. We have a large database of high-energy physics articles kept by Stanford. And you could get at it before the web by knowing exactly what computer to log into over the network, blah, 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 blah. When the web came along, that necessity of knowing which computer to go to, what to say to that computer, and so forth, just disappeared. You know, people put up these pages with the links, and you could just follow links and get to places where you wanted to be and then find everything. And it was also on the same format, so that was very important too, that, you know, we broke this proprietary commercial system of vertical markets, which, you know, don't let you get at anything except if you stay with this particular company or with that particular company. So that horizontal split, that cut that we made between the browsers on top and the databases at the bottom was, I think, essential to make it useful for us, but also to make it useful for everybody else. And so that was what it was like in the beginning. And Tim and I did it on this next machine here in about 1990. So the first server was at about 1990, the first server in the United States came up about a year later at Stanford because of that database that I was talking about before.
You and Tim feel like this was the big one, or it was just...
Well, in a sense, of course, as I always say, we called it World Wide Web in 1990, and Tim had, in fact, a name like that just before that. So there was, in fact, no way of building it smaller than the Internet already was. The Internet was everywhere. So there was no way we could build it smaller. But the thing that we probably did not expect or did not aim for, definitely, in the beginning, at least, was to have this be useful outside the community of academics and internet people that existed then. See, the internet came outside the academic world only, after, I would say, also after 94, right?
That's not from what I think the beginning of the...
Yeah, 94 is what I call the year of the web, so we had the first conferences when you know, Mosaic got off the ground, really, and when commerce started to notice it, companies began to be formed, and so on and so forth, exclusively with that in mind. And that was only then. Before that, it was mainly universities and academics. Gopher was simpler, and easier to install, and easier to populate, and that explained its easier success for a while, because both took off at about the same time. And because the web was somewhat more difficult, it took somewhat longer. But Gopher became also integrated into the web browsers almost instantaneously. And so, you know, after that, after a short while, you saw what you could do with Tibet, what you could do with Gopher, you went to the web. But it was easy, much easier to install Gopher. This is a very, which is why it had a sort of bump where it went ahead of the web for a while. The same is true of Mosaic. Mosaic was just no good, but easier to install. Right? And so it went ahead of what we were trying to do. We were completely killed in the browser environment because what we tried to do with our browsers was more difficult than what Mosaic was trying to do. And so, you know, this proved that a better thing sometimes gets killed or takes much, much longer to come up, because the easier thing, sort of like a virus, you know, outgrows the other one. I think that the real problem was that this development system is so much better than anything else that porting what we had here to any other platform took a lot of my more time. And for example, every time you clicked here, you had a window. Every time you clicked on a diagram, you had a diagram in the window. When you clicked on a map, you got the map in PostScript, scalable, perfectly printable, and so on and so forth. And tried to port that to another system. You got berserk. And this is the reason why in Mosaic you had only one window, and every time you click, you replace the content of that one window, which is not what you wanted. Every time you see a page, you got the images in line, so you scroll, they're gone, and this is all not what we wanted. It's horribly complicated for the user, and it's not efficient, but you know, it was the easiest way to do it on the next system. And so, you know, there you go. So that then spreads, and if you want to make, and you know, there's a big difference between making an editor and something that just puts up a page and you can't do anything with it. So our system from 1990 was also the editor. I mean, I started, it's only after Next stopped making hardware that I had to go back from a Next to a Macintosh that I had to learn HTML. I mean, before we produced all the documentation and stuff, but we never saw any. We never saw any URLs, right? Because you linked by saying link this to that, not by typing in the URL. Right? There was a special window you could call up in which you could type a URL if you needed to, but it wasn't the usual thing. I mean, this navigation bar which says HTTP, I learned all that. The hard way afterwards that you have to use that because you've lost that system, right?
The interesting thing is that I'm HTML for words, language. I'm not the average user, but I like to write. I enjoy it. It's like tech.
Right. It's exactly as bad as tech. That's exactly what it is. It's exactly as bad as tech. And can you imagine that the headings have levels which are absolute?
True. You plus
sir. What HTML was, we just didn't have to, let's realize that we were never more than four people here, Tim and myself and a student each, okay? So things like putting in serious effort into thinking about HTML was a low priority business, and then of course by the time there was time to do that, it had spread beyond repair, right?
That's sort of like minutes, right?
Right, but of course we had
a virus.
In a sense, we have XML coming out, fortunately, so that'll help. This machine here, it's more than 10 years old now. It runs Unix, but it has Unix with a nice visual interface. It had some other interesting things which permitted us to do the development of the web in such a small time, such a short time. And that was, it has a completely object-oriented development system in which there is already supplied as part of the library an editable text object. That was what Tim used to make the first browser. And this was all nice because it got us there very quickly, and then we realized that, you know, somehow the real world uses these horrible machines, and you know, porting it from here to make it available on these horrible machines in the same elegant way is an enormous amount of work. But halfway through 1993, I think we made a last effort in outputting browsers that were also geared to become editors, but then there was just no hope.
So a couple of things on that. He didn't hit me. He was a rather grouchy guy. That was 99. And there was a decision made at CERN probably 95 or 96. CERN could have been the center of the universe for the definition of the World Wide Web. Tim Berners-Lee, who you'll meet in a minute, wanted to kind of run the future of the web from CERN. And CERN said no. CERN said, we're a physics organization, we are not an IT organization. And so Tim Berners-Lee left and went to MIT and formed the World Wide Web Consortium at MIT and left Robert Caillou there. And so it's kind of like been big brother, little brother, and Robert Caillou stayed And you'll see in a moment the locus of the web innovation moved quickly away from CERN. And you can read both Tim Berners-Lee and Robert Caillou wrote some wonderful books about it. That they're just, you just can read the kind of the progression. I'm giving you a very short version of it all. So in 1999, when I run into his office, he's in a grouchy mood, right? Off camera, he was even grouchier than on camera. A woman who was in SI-502 like 3 years ago, she actually started a conversation with him. Turns out he's a lot happier now. I want to go back and film him again because he's like all calm. He realizes that he's like the granddaddy. He's like a grandparent, right? He's at some point, it's like when you have your first grandchild, you want to like leap over top of your children and say how to do it. And he was kind of in that mode. Now he's like, I'm a granddad, you know, and I'm just like, everybody loves me and I love everyone. But he was really grouchy in 1999. So he's not so grouchy anymore. So rest assured. But we'll talk a little bit coming up why Robert Caillou was so grouchy, because the story keeps getting better. Okay. So he also talked about the fact that he didn't like the fact that your web browser, when you click on a link, replaces the page. And that might, for some of you, that might have jumped out. It's like, what is he talking about? Well, the early web browser, this is a screenshot of the early web browser. All images were not in line. There was actually a big battle to move images in line. And the reason was is that what they were doing at CERN was really writing a documentation system. They were writing a distributed version of Wikipedia. They were trying to create documentation for physicists. They were not trying to make Farmville or Facebook, right? They were trying to solve a problem. And it's a good observation on innovation that sometimes the problem that you're focused on, which they were focused on building a cool documentation system for people in Poland and Russia and Germany and Switzerland and the United States to be able to edit each other's documents. That's what they wanted to do, so they could build diagrams for how to build detectors and how to do the analysis and all this detail that they wanted to be perfect. They were not trying to make games. They were not trying to make Angry Birds or Fruit Ninja. And so they had a very different and I think completely rational design philosophy than what we think of as the web today. And so it seems weird what he says. Their goal was to solve this one problem, but they did something wonderful that others then turned into something else that is the web that we see today. And we're going to meet some of those in a bit. So we started at Illinois, went to Michigan, we went to CERN. Our next stop is at Stanford. And we are going to meet Paul Koons at the Stanford Linear Accelerator. Another physicist. You heard Robert mention the physics database. It was running on an IBM mainframe. Now, interestingly, IBM had TCP/IP because of NSFNet. So now Paul has this large database that had a bunch of weird ways to get at it. And he ended up, without knowing it, well, you know, in retrospect, he created the first web server physically in the United States of America. So up to that point, And really, this begins to show where the web starts to lose, where Tim and Robert's initial vision start to sort of morph away. Because Paul, in effect, is building the world's first web search engine, in a sense. So you go from the creation of information, collective creation of information, which is the goal that they had at CERN initially. What year did I talk to Paul? I bet it was 2006. Yes. To the point where it went from more of a producing to a consuming medium. And so we'll let Paul Koons of... let Paul Koons tell the story and then I'll reflect on it. I gotta resist telling the whole story before I let them talk. Another next.
Before there was a web, I embedded a way for
now called instant messaging, and to do a query to the database without logging in. And that improves access to the database, but you still have this terrible language of the database machine to type in order to do your query. A little later on, people added an email interface, so you can send your query by email and you get your response back by email. So when I was at CERN in September 1991, and Tim Demers Lee dragged me into his office to show me a mobile web, at first I wasn't very interested, but when he demonstrated doing a query to a health system database on the mainframe, I immediately put two and two together and said, well, if you can query a health system on the mainframe, you can query a database on the mainframe. And I started getting interested. The thing is that we couldn't change the query commands. That was open the database. But the web page would give you an example to remind you what the query would be.
So did you have to write it all from scratch? I mean, did you write it from the protocol, or was there a software that you used to make your first web server?
Well, I used the CERN server software to create C. Unfortunately, we had a C compiler working at that time. It wasn't very long. We had a C compiler, but we had one. So all I had to do was to write some extra C code to get the query that the user had made and turn it into when it was December 12, 1991, we installed our web server. And we informed Tim Berners-Lee that they could do their job. The big boost came about a month later in January in southern France with a workshop on computing topics for high engineering physics. And at that workshop, Tim Berners-Lee had a plenary talk. So he gave his hour-long talk to about 200 and as part of his talk, he gave a demo. And at the very end, the most people want to think before most of the time, the worst thing that software people want to think about is documentation and pitching documentation. But at the end of the talk, he connected to Slack web server and made a query. And that really dropped the jaws. Because the instant everybody knew the database, everybody knew how hard it was to access. Okay. And here he just clicked away, typed in a few things, the query turned back, the results came back, and it's appropriate. So, the way I said it, the interest in the web went from about 20 people to 200 people in that hour. Okay. Now, those 200 people went back home, and each one of them told 10 people. Then, within a week, the interest in the web grew to 2,000 people. So that was a big turning point. I think Tim recognized that it was really the big one. And I think the reason that the web took off so quickly was the commerce communication started to realize it. It's a win-win situation. Okay. It's a win for the customer, obviously, because he can do price comparisons, he can browse his airline schedules on installments, visualize what he wants to see quickly, he can try different things. He has to get the price down. So it's much, much better for the consumer. But what about the provider, the airline? Well, it's much better for them because it's just software that's running on machines. Okay? It's much lower cost for them. And so they're winning too. I pointed out in my talk about the web near the end, so punchline, that in doing big science, we're finding solutions to problems that the general public don't know they have. So who would predict that out of high physics research would become something like a web would come up with? I think that would be unpredictable. But in hindsight, you can see that it was a natural place for the web to move.
So if you think about it, right, how many people in here regularly edit Wikipedia, right? But how many people use a search engine, right? So that's the point. If the web had stayed kind of Wikipedia for physicists, like, you know, maybe there'd be 500 people that finally heavily used it. But the moment it became a consumable, where consuming of the information was you know, practical. It's like a lot of people want to consume information. Some people want to make it. Now, a lot of people want to make websites, drchuck.com, and all this. There's a certain vanity, but even though I have a website, the fraction of the time I spend consuming versus the time I'm spending making, I'm consuming 98% of the time, even though I'm a heavy producer of stuff on the internet, right? And so this is a moment where someone finally saw that this was a consuming medium. And this theme will continue. So before we sort of hit the real kickoff, and frankly, this, as Paul Kuhn says, we're talking hundreds of people here. We're talking tens of servers and hundreds of people. And you also heard Robert Caillou mention this thing called Gopher. Well, Gopher was this thing at University of Minnesota, and it was a simple hierarchical menu-based navigation system. You had this client, and you would click down menus and then find documents. There's very little individual material. It was really great for organizations to put stuff up. You probably still find the University of Michigan Gopher server somewhere. Is this Michigan's? Oh, that's Illinois' Gopher. Okay. So, and as Robert said, this Gopher thing was, both Gopher and the web happened in 1990. And Gopher took the world by storm. And the web was a much more slower burn. And I wasn't at this meeting in April 1993. The Internet Engineering Task Force is where the standards get built that run the internet. But a friend of mine, Richard Wiggins, who's on the I did a TV thing, let's just see in a second. He was in it. And at this meeting, they had two birds of a feather session. One was the Gopher bird of a feather session, and the other was the web bird of a feather session. And 200 people filled the room, people in the hallway, climbing on top of each other to hear about Gopher. And in another room, Tim Berners-Lee was sitting there with 15 other people, almost in tears. He was trying to tell people about the web, and nobody cared. And the quote, I wasn't in the room, I didn't film it, but the quote was, is like, why doesn't anybody like what I made? And everyone said, it's just too hard. Gopher's easy, the web is hard. We 15 love you, but the rest of the world doesn't. So this is a long time ago. DVD was invented in that same time. In 1993 was a very dark, dark moment. Okay, the web might never have happened. But it gets worse before it gets better. This is a commercial from 1993. Gosh, let me see if I can find this. Chuck Talks. Hang on, I'm going to hide my screen for a second. Hurry. I just can't show you. There's something I can't show you until later. Oh. Okay. So I'm going to show you a video. And at the end, it is going to show the name of the company. So you got 30 seconds on this one. So I want you to guess, before you're shown at the end, what company made this commercial in 1993? Okay? So I want you to guess. Don't shout it.
Have you ever renewed your driver's license? Had a cash machine?
Nice picture.
Fixed your car. With a
television.
You have a problem with your motion. Did you want to relax? Move your hand. Or have
an assistant. Here. Who lived in your computer? The reference machine. I gathered the information. Talking to me. And I'm still working on this plan. You will.
And the company that'll bring it to you,
AT&T. So let's see. Where did we meet AT&T earlier? So AT&T saw it all coming, right? AT&T wanted to create for us a highly connected world with all kinds of wonderful equipment. They wanted to make it so we could stream video from our garages and watch video in our garages. But AT&T wanted to charge you for every single thing, right? So, yeah. Yeah, and it's really continuous. So I just filmed Vint Cerf, who did his major work between 1970 and 1979, and has been sort of like a. And Doug Van Holling and Vint Cerf were in the same office because Doug is doing an oral history of this whole thing, right? That's highly much more detailed than mine. Mine's kind of like the People Magazine version. Doug's going to be the real detailed version. As soon as the camera went off, as soon as the camera shut off, my cameras and Doug's camera, we shut them off. You saw these two sort of smiling guys in the interview. Oh, and packets are cool. And then like all the smile went out of their faces. And they started talking about the State Department and the Department of Commerce and this idiot at such and so a place and the people coming from this country doing this and that. And we got to get these other people and this other person. I mean, literally. I'm not as deep in it this as Vint and Doug are, but they were just talking about the threats, right? They were talking about the threats like today, day before yesterday. I mean, they just went on and on and on and on about like, you got to go find out that person and you got to go, we got to find that person because that one person at Department of Justice, yada, 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 just going and going. So the bottom line is that this tension is still today. HIPAA, SOPA, EPA, whatever, they just keep coming. The Record Association, I mean, yeah.
As interdisciplinary information professionals aspiring, what are some of the publications we should be reading or more, or what should we be listening to, or?
As a faculty member who likes empowering his students to do things like that, I have no freaking idea. And we should probably make a wiki or something. I mean, I'm kind of like the reporter in all this, right? I'm not the, you know. And it's unfortunate that all the best stuff in these interviews is the stuff that happened when the camera turns off, right? And there's, I mean, I'll tell you some of the stuff in some of the other ones where as soon as the camera turns off, you get like, this story is bad enough, let alone the stuff that was talked about when the camera goes off, right? So yeah, the tension is scary, right? And it's like governments and it's scarier and scarier because the stakes are so high now. Even it was scary when the stakes weren't high. So AT&T basically said, I will make computers for you. I will make everything. I'll make whatever. And you'll just like have a little meter running on everything. And it'll be great. It might actually be better. Or it might be a dysfunctional steampunk future for all we know. Or it might be better. We don't know. So 1993, the web is complete failure, it appears. The gopher is triumphant. AT&T is about ready to take over the universe and destroy the internet and give us little square iPad-like devices in 1993. So we've gone to the University of Michigan. We've escaped to CERN. We've gone to Stanford. And now we are going to go where the shit really is going to hit the fan. And that is back, surprisingly, to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign at the National Center for Supercomputing Application. Because up to this point, it's just a bunch of academics in rooms. It really is just a bunch of academics. But it's not going to be academics for long. So in 1994, Robert Caillou mentioned that 94 was the year of the web. And 1993 was when Tim Berners-Lee was almost sobbing because he saw the web dying. But by 94, 95, it was all over. And one thing did it. One thing did it. A piece of software called Mosaic. The shot fired round the world. Shot heard round the world is what Mosaic was called. And what happened with Mosaic was it was the first web browser that worked not just on Unix workstations, because everything we've talked about, you had to have a $13,000 Unix workstation to be on the web. But at NCSA, they made a web browser that worked on Macintosh and Windows and Unix workstations. And now moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas can get on the internet. And I told you that the internet itself, the dial-up and all that had been busting out, but like with text-based bulletin board systems, right? So the infrastructure of getting people connected to the network, getting network capabilities inside operating systems, that was all there. but there was no graphical user interface for it to make it really usable for the rest of the people. So the first really broad web browser was created at the NCSA at University of Illinois. Okay, I just won't take Joseph's thunder. Now Joseph Hardin, you'll see his title is not University of Illinois, because afterwards he came to University of Michigan. He was one of my bosses. He founded the Sakai project that is CTools. So I worked for him as his chief architect when I did my Sakai CTools work. Joseph was the one who got all the money. And you will see that he's doing exactly to me, he did exactly to me what he did to Mark Andreessen. And that is, Joseph didn't write the software, but he gave the people permission and money to write the software. And I think I talked to Joseph in 2000, no, the years are rolling together again. Come on, maybe I talked to him in 2007. Joseph, oh wait, that's in my talks, never mind. Got to go to Publish Media. When did I talk to Joseph? Hardin. God damn it. Here we go. 2010. Okay. So this is 2010. This is relatively recent. I'll explain in a second why it's recent.
And nobody was working yet on the Windows or the Mac version. And we saw the first version of that come out in, what, the early 93, late 92, and it's probably early 93. And the response, of course, was fantastic. It's wonderful to be able to just click on something and see it right away. And indeed, the combination of hyperlinks in a document as far as navigation and retrieval of documents and the user interface is just great. And a lot of people got it immediately, especially people who were working with the tools at NCSA and the companies. I remember an HP exec coming in one time, and Mark and Eric had written a little filter that took units, documentation, and made it into HTML and made all of the references into links. And they went through, they hit an HP site, and the exec said, "Where's this coming from?" Because he was able to see all the HP documentation there and go to NCSA and navigate to it pretty easily. And he said, "Well, you've got three or four folks down here that have put up an HTTP service. You may not know what those are yet." He said, "Never heard of it." And he said, "But this is the kind of thing that is probably going to be really useful in the future for people who are trying to manage documentation in a distributed fashion." Yada, 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 right? And went on with a story like that. And this guy was down in the DC. And this was the kind of response that he got. In 93, late 93, early 94, there's this full suite of mosaics that work across X Windows, the Mac, and the Windows system. And that's the point at which the guy who was the president at the time of the Internet Association said, NCSA has fired a shot for the ground zero. It's available now across all these platforms, and anybody can use it. And we saw, you know, an exponential growth in the number of HTTP servers and traffic and all that stuff that went on there. And Tim, of course, Tim Berners-Lee at this time, would say, well, he had seen an exponential growth from the very beginning. And he's right. We're both right. We had seen it from the time we brought out the browsers, and they certainly helped with it. There was already an underlying exponential, I think, that's going on in people being able to put up their materials easily with HTML and do all that. I remember sitting in rooms with commercial folks that came in and pitched to us, and I'd bring the whole team in, the whole software development group, and say, "Listen to these guys. You know, tell me what you think about this." And we were, nobody was sure what it was going to do. And there were people who started off building browsers and just kind of never got off the ground. It wasn't until the Netscape effort started up that there was sufficient energy and sufficient resources, I think, to really get on live and push and you know, crank up a group of X hundred developers in a matter of months, and then they were, you know, quickly overshadowed by the effort that Microsoft put through. I remember one of the Netscape guys saying, I came back from a meeting with some folks up in Seattle, and they said that Microsoft now had, this is when Netscape was writing at the top of its form, right? Top of the game. This guy said, Microsoft just told me that somebody from Microsoft said that they've got like 2,000 developers. But at that point, I realized that we were, you know, going to have to do it. And we, of course, always felt that there should be more than one browser. And so we wanted, because we were interested in standards and openness, right, at the time, when there's only one browser, the next company gets to determine what the standards are. There were all kinds of apples early on about putting in different features and the browsers driving the standards rather than the standards driving the browsers and all this kind of stuff. So we wanted some diversity. But nobody, I don't think, in 93, maybe by 94, but in 93 we were still amazed at what we had and amazed at the response and just tickled pink, thrilled, the whole idea of this being something that a lot of people were going to find useful and we were going to have a lot of fun playing. They had no real sense. Everybody talked, we talked about all the possibilities, but we had no real sense that it would take off and simply monetize so quickly. If you go back and you ask people who were sitting in front of machines in 1993, 94, 95, right? You say, you remember the first time you used a browser? It wasn't the same. And the vast majority of them that I remember say, yeah, I can remember.
So just a couple of things. now let's see, a couple of things. So everybody that you've met so far kind of fits in the same mold. They're sort of like aging hippies, and they really sort of believe in making the world a better place, and they don't really have a selfish bone in their body. I mean, literally, I met these people and I know these people and they're all aging hippies, right? And all they wanted to do was enjoy each other and make the world a better place. This is kind of the first moment where we see greed sneak in to the mix. Mark Andreessen, who was like on the cover of Forbes just a couple of months ago, was a student programmer working for Joseph. And it was clear this thing was going to be big, and Mark Andreessen ran off to California to start a company called Netscape and became a zillionaire because of Netscape. But Netscape had evil intent. Netscape wanted to make the browser and the web server completely proprietary. They didn't want there to be more than one browser. They wanted to be only one browser, and you had to buy it from Netscape. They never were really successful selling it, but their intent was to sell it, not to give it away for free. Microsoft saw this, and you heard Joseph refer to this. Microsoft saw this happening and realized that if Netscape was successful in creating a Mac, Unix, and Windows piece of software and server software that made your choice of operating system irrelevant, it would quickly put Windows out of business. So in 1994, Bill Gates turned the company on a dime and said, our operating system, Windows 95, will be the internet operating system. It will have TCP/IP built in it. It will have a web browser, and we will give away a free web browser. And this, Joseph referred to this, where there's a battle. Now, it turns out that Microsoft tried to buy Netscape, and Netscape wanted too much money, and so Microsoft decided, we will kill you. And they did. Netscape knew they were going to die shortly after Microsoft decided they were going to die. And I don't know if I have time to tell the whole story. Okay, I'll just talk until I run out of time. So as Netscape is created, Joseph Hardin did something that I consider maybe one of the most amazing things in the history of intellectual property. Mosaic had been created, and Netscape was created, and he went to the lawyers at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and told them that they should take the source code to Mosaic and release it with a free open source license and not charge anyone to license the world's greatest browser that had ever been seen, that had changed the world forever. I do not know how he convinced them to say yes. In my conversation with Larry Smarr was Joseph's boss. Larry Smarr basically, I think, was part of the conversation, and what he said to me was he convinced them that they didn't want to like run a software publishing house and do tech support. Said university's job is not to do this. University's job is to do something creative. Let somebody else like make the boxes and stock things and answer 800 numbers 24 hours a day. These are not the droids you're looking for. But of course it became a $1 trillion industry afterwards. Now here's the irony of the whole thing. I guess these kind of things you get off the camera. So Illinois gave away Mosaic for free with a very liberal license that said anyone could do anything they want to it. Turns out that 50 companies licensed it anyways, one of which was Microsoft. back then, open source was not a legally tested concept. So Microsoft came to the University of Illinois and said, we would like to buy a license for Mosaic to use it as part of Internet Explorer. And they said, you don't have to. It's free. And they said, you don't understand. We would like to buy a license to use Mosaic in Internet Explorer. They go, it's free. You don't understand. We would like to buy a license. So for over a decade, Microsoft gave money to the University of Illinois because they were unsure of the legality of taking something for free. It was cheaper to write them millions of dollars of checks for something that was technically free. Like 50 companies ended up paying University of Illinois. Just these days, everyone understands open source, but I should just do a whole class on this. So that's cool. So Netscape then took the open source stuff and then competed against it. They were mean. I was glad that they died. I still hate Marc Andreessen for that. So then Microsoft is trying to kill Netscape. And like these are two people, Mitchell Baker. I'm going to try to interview Mitchell when I go to Barcelona in 2 weeks. Maybe I'll get an interview for Mitchell. Maybe I'll finally get Mitchell on. I know Mitchell, and I've known her for years, but she's so busy I just can't pin her down to get a camera in front of her. I got Brendan. He's online. I can send you URLs to that. So as Netscape, and Brendan says this on camera on that one there, as Netscape was dying, it was looking for ways to survive. And Netscape finally died and got bought by AOL, and there's this Time Warner mess, and all this thing got all messed up, right? And the Netscape people become kind of like this under-the-radar guerrilla people. And they were the people that were running Netscape, Mitchell and Brendan, and they decided that they would take the software and slowly move it into the open source. So they took the Netscape code and created an open source project called the Mozilla Project. The Mozilla Project was a rewrite of the Netscape code. And Brendan and Mitchell would sneak stuff out when no one was looking into the open source. And they did this for years, sneaking stuff into the open source. And Mitchell started spending more time working with the open source people than working with their masters, America Online and Time Warner. And finally, these America Online and Time Warner figured this out, that they basically had like aging hippies in their midst that were taking all their good stuff and putting it in the open source and working more in the open source than working on their stuff. So they fired Mitchell. But she didn't stop doing her job. She created this little tiny Mozilla Foundation, right? And they didn't fire Brendan for another year, but he kept like moving stuff over. And so there was this Mozilla Foundation. The early Mozilla browser was kind of a joke. It was a piece of crap, right? And so they had built the first Mozilla browser, which was a piece of crap. Then they started on this long rewrite that was fully open source. And they had just very few people and just a bunch of crazy hippies again. And Firefox was the rewrite of the Mozilla browser. And what happened was, is the standards had changed with HTML and CSS and all the modern kind of browser standards, and Microsoft had gotten lazy. So Microsoft's Internet Explorer was kind of going into the toilet in terms of being quality for the newest websites. And Firefox came out just at the moment where Microsoft was getting lazy. Firefox went from like nothing to a 35% market share. And they That's okay. I'm running out of things to say. And they invented. I only got 6%. Could I borrow some electricity?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. Oh, your computer's too modern. Can I borrow your electricity? That's not going to work either. Do you have the adapter? Oh. Okay, I'll use your plug and her plug, and together I will have enough electricity to finish the slides. Okay. So these people invented the search box on the browser. Google gave them like a penny every time you clicked. So all of a sudden, these impoverished hippies became exceedingly wealthy with virtually unlimited amounts of money. But they did not believe in anything but open source, so they refused to switch. So the Mozilla Foundation today is all passionate about open, open, open. They hire employees, but they won't let the employees work on the code until they prove to the rest of the people working on the software. So like Brendan and Mitchell just got it going straight up. And they're making tons of money, and that's Firefox, and lots of you are probably using Firefox. Now, of course, it's not clear that Google Chrome is trying to kill them again, but we'll have to see. So, just point out, sometimes people who we think of as bad guys turn out to be good guys. Microsoft, in some ways, saved the open web, right? They didn't set out to save the open web, but by killing Netscape and not being able to charge for the browser, they inadvertently created the open web. So, in all this, you heard Joseph talk about standards. I also told you that CERN had sort of the option to run the future of the internet and gave that up. And Tim Berners-Lee went to MIT and formed the World Wide Web Consortium that now creates HTML and CSS and all these standards that govern the web. This was not assured to be a success. But everyone was so scared and hateful of Netscape that companies like Microsoft immediately joined Tim Berners-Lee, the grandfather of it all, to make the World Wide Web Consortium everybody but Netscape. So all of a sudden, Tim Berners-Lee and the World Wide Web Consortium became kind of a class act, and MIT didn't hurt, right, having it at MIT. And so the World Wide Web Consortium, poof, shows up. Joseph worked on the World Wide Web Consortium. Tim Berners-Lee worked on the World Wide Web Consortium, and it continues to this day, and Tim Berners-Lee still runs the World Wide Web Consortium out of MIT. So now it's time to meet Tim. This film actually is not, I didn't do this film. Let's see, where am I going to find this? I should have a better way of organizing this stuff. Timbal. Is Timbal in here somewhere? Yeah, there we go. We call him, everyone calls him Timbal. Timbal, Timbal, Timbal. Is this the one? Yeah, so this one has a warning on Chuck's hairstyle as well. This is when I was coloring my hair and going gray and trying to fight the going of gray. I've stopped fighting the going of gray. And so this is a short bit of Tim Berners-Lee that just is in the context of the television program.
Last month I was off in Boston for the 4th annual World Wide Web Conference, and I had the opportunity to talk to the inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, and I asked him a little bit about where are we going with this web stuff. And we had this little bit of footage from Tim telling us where that's going to be.
You haven't seen nothing yet, but you wait until people assume the web. When the web becomes a new consumer, when the web, the infrastructure is all laid down, we have an information space, then it will be time for the next revolution. Who knows what that will be?
It's hard to imagine a greater revolution than what we've seen. I mean, I go to the smallest places and everybody's putting up a web thing.
Right, the web could only take place, the web revolution could only take place because the internet, which had been a quieter, smaller revolution, but that idea of the internet itself, partly being deployed throughout the world, had happened because the internet is something people could assume the web revolution could take place. When the web is something you can assume, then maybe a cultural revolution, an isocultural revolution, maybe a cultural revolution, perhaps, or maybe we'll find ways of doing things better than we haven't imagined.
Pretty neat, Rich. One of the things that I liked about it was he just said his idea was the next step is something completely different, cultural revolution is compared to just a little more technology.
So that was Tim Berners-Lee's vision in 1995. It's strangely predictive of recent events that continue to unfold, right? That we can assume a communication fabric. Will it change culture? Will it change the human existence? Will it cause the need to create a school of information where we connect people, information, and technology in more interesting ways and create a whole raft of information technology professionals to struggle with this particular problem? And so I'd like to get a longer interview of Tim at some point. So You can probably figure out whether Tim Berners-Lee is one of those selfish people or one of those aging hippies that just wants to make the world a better place. I assume you saw Tim Berners-Lee in the opening ceremonies of the London Olympics. A lot of people didn't know why he was there, but I hope now you know why he was there. Before we meet our next guest speaker, I just want to point out again that the people that you've met so far are nice people. They share. They are often in their conversations talking about everybody else who made their work possible. They deflect fame from themselves. It's one of the reasons I point cameras at them, so that you can meet the people who really did it, because they will never come to you and tell you what they've done. They will just quietly walk around and just never say anything, because to them, it was a collective. They didn't really want to change the world. They didn't want to make money. They were just trying to solve a wonderful problem, but together they collectively solved something. That's really cool. I mentioned the books that Tim Berners-Lee and Caillou wrote. They're really lovely books because they're really gentle first-person kind of narrative accounts, right? They're not trying to tell you, just like, and then on March 15th we went here and then we talked to these people. They're just lovely. They're like diaries, basically, and both of them are really quite nice. So, the last person that we're going to meet is the founder of Amazon.com, Jeff Bezos. And I didn't film this. My co-host, Richard Wiggins from the television show, filmed this. And I will call your attention to the different affect and the different hair color. He's probably slimmer, knows how to dress, unlike everyone you've met so far, who's like old and chubby. This was filmed in 1997. The internet came out in 1994, okay, so that's 3 years later. And this is Jeff Bezos. He was filmed at the SLA, Special Libraries Association Conference, Seattle, Washington, in 1997, where he was giving a talk in a room about this size, full of librarians, and saying, hey, you might want to buy books from an online bookstore that I just made called Amazon. And we catch him outside, just say, hey, Jeff, you're done with your talk? Can we stick a camera in your face? Of course, he's bigger than this now, but that's what we did back then. This should be in the 1997 folder if my organization is accurate. Oh, shit. No, not that one, not that. Okay, so this is Jeff Bezos. By the way, if you look closely, just show you how we're really kind of like a crazy documentary filmmakers. There's this little baby that comes running in, and I messed it up. And you'll see the interview restart as the baby and the mom comes running. We don't do this, you know. It's like get the footage, right? Get these people, catch them.
Well, 3 years ago, I was in New York City working for a quantitative hedge fund when I came across this startling statistic that web usage was growing at 2,300% a year. So I decided I would try and find a business plan that made sense in the context of that growth. And I picked books as the first best product to sell online, which made me a list of like 20 different products that you might be able to sell. And books were great as the first best, because books are incredibly unusual in one respect. And that is, there are more items in the book category than there are items in any other category by far. Music is number two. There are about 200,000 active music CDs at any given time. But in the book space, there are more than 3 million different books worldwide active and in print at any given time across all languages. More than 1.5 million in English alone. So when you have that many items, you literally build a store online that couldn't exist any other way. And that's important right now because the web is still an infant technology. Basically right now, if you can do things using a more traditional method, you probably should do them using the more traditional method.
What kind of inventory do you need?
we inventory the best-selling books at any given time. We're inventorying in our own warehouse only a couple of thousand titles. And then we do almost a time inventory for another 400,000 titles or so. We get those from a network of electronically from a network of wholesalers and distributors. We order those today. They're on our loading dock the next morning. Then for another 1.1 million titles, we get those directed to 20,000 different publishers, and those can take a couple of weeks to get. And then there are a million out-of-print books in our catalog. We have a catalog of 2.5 million books altogether. Those million out-of-print books, some of them we can get and some of them we can't, but we find them. If we can't, then we ship them to our customers. We have a search on those.
What's almost in time inventory?
Almost in time inventory is a phrase we use to describe a whole selection of books that we offer. It's basically the things that are, you know, below the 2,000 best-selling book up to the 400,000 best-selling book. Those are titles we can get from a network of more than a dozen different wholesalers. So if a customer orders a book from us today, we order that book from our wholesalers today, and that book shows up on our loading dock the next morning, and then we can ship it to the customer.
They say one of the toughest things to do on the internet is to capture mind share. What was your secret? How did you do that?
Yeah, even more generally, I agree with you that, you know, capturing mind share on the internet is extremely difficult. Even more generally, it's the late 20th century, not just the internet. You know, capturing attention. Attention is the scarce commodity of the late 20th century. And one of the ways that you can do that is the way that we did it, was by doing something new and innovative for the first time that actually has real value for the customer. That's a hard thing to do, but if you do that, then newspapers will write about you, what you're doing. Customers will tell other customers. You get a huge word of mouth fan out, and that can really drive and accelerate businesses. And that's what happened with us. In the first year of opening Amazon.com to the public, we didn't do any paid advertising, and all of our growth was fueled by word of mouth and media exposure.
I saw a little ads at the bottom of the column of the New York Times.
That was our very first advertising. We don't do that anymore, but at the very beginning, we did little tiny ads at the bottom of the front page of the New York Times.
I thought that was very clever, sort of using the URL as a macro, because I read
it. It expands.
We're a bookstore, click here.
Right, that's a great way to think of it.
And it worked very well, apparently.
I don't know, you know, the problem with that kind of advertising is it's extremely difficult to track.
Put another URL for every...
That's the problem, is you want people to start to learn your URL, so you don't want to actually use a different one. And it's very easy. One of the great things about online ads, we do advertising today in maybe 40 different different websites, we do banner ads, and that advertising is very easy to track in terms of knowing how effective it is. So we know each piece of creative in each venue, not only how many click-throughs we get, but how many sell-throughs we get, how many dollars of revenue generates per ad dollar spent on that creative in that venue. And that is a sort of a marketer's, nirvana in a certain sense.
Well, it's an exciting place to be on the web right now.
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, it's just incredible. This is, what's really incredible about this is that this is day one. This is the very beginning. This is the Kitty Hawk stage of electronic commerce. We're moving forward in so many different areas. Lots of different companies are as well. And the late 20th century is just a great time to be alive. You know, we're going to find out that, I think a millennium from now, people are going to look back and say, wow, the late 20th century was really a great time to be alive on this planet.
So, just a little reflection on that. That's the guy that's bringing you Kindle, right? That's the guy that's doing Amazon Web Services. He is a smart, smart fellow, right? I don't take any of my comments and say, like, somehow he's bad, right? Taking and turning this into something wonderful for all of us is the job of commerce to do. And just sort of one final thought. He was describing the long tail, right? The long tail and all this stuff. The book Long Tail was written by some expert in 2005. He was doing the long tail in 1996, right? So that just tells you, like, how much smarter he is than whatever expert wrote the book Long Tail, right? So everyone's writing books about what he was doing in 96, 97, 98. And so that suggests that buying stock in Amazon's not a bad idea, right? Because he is no dummy. He is still very much in control of that company, and I expect really, really great things from Amazon. I think they're kind of really an unsung hero in this whole thing. So, okay, well, thank you all. We'll see you next week, where we'll talk more technical about this exact same thing.